What's the most important thing you can have to have a great retirement? Well, we can all agree it's your health. But what can you do today to maintain your level of wellness and fitness? In this special best of edition of the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, we take a look at revisiting some of the conversations we've had with experts on how to do just that. You can find links in the show notes to each full conversation, but I think it'll give you a multi-dimensional look at this critical topic.
The CDC actually has addressed that, and they believe that 80% of heart disease and stroke and diabetes and 40% of cancer is preventable with lifestyle change. The CDC is about as conservative an institution in American medicine as exists. I think that almost all arthritis, particularly osteoarthritis, is preventable. I think that loss of mobility as we age is inevitable, but it doesn't have to decline quickly. Having major diseases become and being thought of as preventable problems that can be mitigated is really a game changer if what you're worried about is being sidelined by a critical illness that you don't have the ability to sway the course of. So having more control than you think means that you can make better choices and that they will matter. And after 50, almost all of aging is your choices. Before 50, your genetics have a lot to say. But as if you make it to 50, you can change your life if your habits haven't been good to not just improve your longevity, but improve your quality of life and, of course, your flexibility, your energy level, your curiosity, your cognitive alertness, your ability to communicate. There are a lot of amazing things you can do with lifestyle change.
You'll also want to listen to our conversation with Dr. Kelly Harding, who's also an MPH, and she's the author of the book, The Rabbit Effect. And she educates us about the importance of the mind-body connection and the fact that things like kindness, compassion, and other things we do and how we show up in our day-to-day lives really can impact our health and the well-being of others.
But I guess here's the really shocking statistic is that we know that lifestyle factors are important, and we know that medical care and access to quality medical care is absolutely critical for every human being, but it probably only accounts, you know, for medical care only accounts for about 10 to 20% of our overall health status. And the rest of it has to do with our social world and all these hidden factors in our homes, relationships, communities, workplaces, schools that we need to be talking and addressing that we often don't think about as health. So the kale smoothie is certainly important, but I would also encourage you to have that kale smoothie with somebody that you care about.
Well, I'm in luck. Joe's going to share his kale smoothie with me today.
Right. Well, I think that's the thing. Like, you look at sort of like blue zones or other areas where people live a long time. And the thing is, we get, as Americans, we often get quite focused on like the diet and, you know, what are they eating? How are they working out? But it's like, actually, you know, who are they eating with and who are they working out with? Because there's also this social connection component that unfortunately we're somewhat missing in many. We know from the loneliness data, we're really missing the boat on in a lot of our communities around the world and in our country.
What role do relationships and social ties play in our health and our longevity?
So for listeners, if there is one thing that you can invest in for your health, it's building positive relationships. And this pans out in multiple studies. And in fact, the longest running study ever, which has been done out of Harvard, shows that, you know, the number one predictor of somebody's health is actually positive relationships. So pay attention. You want to treat, just like we all, you know, think about exercise, diet, all those kale smoothies, we also want to think about, and as part of our health regimen, like, who are we hanging out with? Who are we connecting with on a daily or weekly basis? And do what we can to try to boost that. The data really supports that.
So what about all these superfoods that you've been reading about in all the articles over the last month or so? Could those be the ticket? We spoke with science journalist Marta Zaraska. She thinks there's a better way. She's the author of the book, Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100.
I think a lot of people are over-investing in diet and exercise. So, you know, eating healthy is, in fact, quite simple. So I just really love how Michael Pollan once said, he said, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. And it's basically it, you know, just eat your veggies, don't overindulge in fast food, and do some physical exercise. But we just spend so much time and so much money in reading about fad diets and miracle foods and supplements and herbs and vitamins and purchasing exercise gadgets and exercise apps and so on and so on. And, you know, I've been there myself. When I lived in US, I lived in Philadelphia and very, very near a very big Whole Foods. And I was a very frequent customer and I spent lots of time and lots of money there. And now I would know better, I guess, I hope. And we really spend so much time on these things, whereas some of them have really sometimes no effect on our health at all. For example, omega-3 fatty acids or vitamin C, they have no effect on your longevity basically at all. And some things, such multivitamin pills, can actually have negative health effects. This has been shown in research over and over. And yet we still go for those things, completely forgetting, for example, things like looking for purpose in life, which actually does matter for our longevity and health a lot.
So we know exercise is an important piece of the puzzle. But what if you don't love exercise? We spoke with Kelly McGonigal. She's the author of the book, The Joy of Movement, on how we can reframe exercise.
Well, there's one thing that happens almost universally. It's called the feel better effect. And that's the fact that if you have been inactive, you've been sitting around, lying around, sedentary for any period of time, and then you begin to move your body. So you get your heart rate up a little bit, your blood is flowing to your muscles, you're breathing more deeply. Most people will immediately feel more energy and more positive. That's sort of how psychologists talk about mood. How much energy do you have and how positive or negative is your outlook? And no matter where you start out, you could start out low energy and negative, you know, depressed or bored or feeling a lack of hope. And getting active in any way tends to move you in that direction of feeling more energy and more positive. You could start out feeling really high energy and negative, like angry or anxious, and it somehow transforms that energy into a more positive source of energy that you can use. So that's called the feel better effect. And again, that seems to be the fact that simply you get a little boost of adrenaline, a little boost of dopamine in your brain, and people feel better when they're active. So that's like the low hanging fruit. And again, it works no matter what your body, no matter what your physical ability, no matter what your age, it's what you can do in this moment, you know, to stand up, stretch, dance to a song in your living room, go for a walk around the block. And then there's much deeper effects, and we can talk about the science behind it or how it works. But we also know that in addition to that immediate feel better boost, that exercising on a regular basis profoundly transforms the brain, both how the brain works and also even the physical structure of your brain in ways that make you more resilient to stress and even more sensitive to positive emotions like love and gratitude and hope. And it can be an effective therapy for things like depression and trauma and grief, in addition to all the other things that can be really helpful for those conditions. So sort of no matter where you are on the spectrum, you're looking to just feel a little bit better right now because you're tired, or you're looking to work with really serious psychological challenges, exercise seems to be something that's really good medicine.
So how do you make these practices part of your day-to-day life and take charge of your wellness? Well, you start small. Matter of fact, our next guest encourages you to start tiny. BJ Fogg, PhD, is the author of Tiny Habits, and I've used the Tiny Habits method since 2014 personally. I can assure you, this three-step method is very, very helpful.
So with Tiny Habits, essentially, with this method, you can wire new habits into your life really fast, and it's easy. But those open the door to making bigger changes. In my research, over 70% of people who do Tiny Habits, within the five-day window, they start doing other new habits naturally. So there's this ripple effect. And about 20% of people who do tiny habits do something big. So the tiny changes, the feeling of success for making these tiny changes opens the door for people to do something they might have been afraid to do previously. So you get one, the habits ripple out. The habits will affect other aspects of your life. And the third one I didn't talk about is the habit will grow. You know, if you start with just two push-ups, it can grow over time. But you start it small, just like a plant. You know, you don't start like a huge palm tree. You can, but that takes a lot of care and feeding. And that's when you start tapping into willpower and motivation. There's a better way. You start it really tiny and find the right spot for it. You know, the common thing that you hear is like repetition. And repetition is what creates habits. But that's not actually accurate. When you look at the studies that people cite when they're saying that, the study shows, does not show that repetition causes habits. It shows that it correlates with habits. So they're mixing up correlation and causation. So what causes the habit to form? It's the emotion you feel when you do that behavior or immediately after. And the specific emotion in tiny habits that I advocate and teach people to feel is the feeling of success. So let's take your case, Joe. So let's say when you're first starting your push-up habit, if you do one or two push-ups or whatever you started with, and you allow yourself to feel successful, and there's ways to do that that I discussed, but sticking with emotions here, if you feel successful in doing that, then the habit of doing push-ups will start. It actually, that emotion rewires your brain. So your brain actually changes. It's the sheathing along the neurons that the emotions will trigger a sequence of things that actually changes your brain and wires that habit in. So really, emotions are the key to habit formation.
You'll find the links to the full conversations in the show notes, and you can browse all 100 plus of our episodes on our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you'll also find a range of free tools, including a quiz, financial calculators, longevity calculators, and other resources that can help you retire smarter.